This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Entik. It's our Chinese New Year special. And in this year of the dog, I have in the studio with me Dr. Yong Min Hui, an experimental psychologist who spent a large part of her academic career studying the emotional interior of man's best friend. Dr. Yong, welcome and happy Chinese New Year to you.
Thank you for the invitation and
Are you a believer in Chinese astrology?
No.
Okay. Spoken like a true academic. Your research set up, so this was the research that was conducted during your doctoral years when you were studying for your PhD. Mm-hmm. And you set out to understand whether dogs can empathize or whether they truly feel empathy or they're just displaying traits of empathy. Why were you interested in this question?
Maybe I'll start off a little bit by saying actually it was not so much about empathy, but rather about dogs understanding our human emotions. So there were various studies, short studies, and one of it was involving empathy. So what started it was because this is in the research actually falls in the realm of comparative psychology. So we compare men versus non-human. And, you know, in non-human studies, it can be, you know, your rodents, your rat, mouse, mice. It can be your chimps, your primates. But with dogs, it's very interesting for one main reason. They are called man's best friend because of the close proximity, the domestication that happened over hundreds of thousands of years. Dogs as a whole is able to pick up quite a reasonable amount of social interaction, things which we don't see in the other, you know, animal models. And that started the ball rolling. And because they are so close to us, the question then comes, are they doing this because we domesticated them? Or is it because it is an evolving trait? Is it part of evolution that they are able to do such things?
So what did you find in this study?
So what I found in this study essentially was they do respond. And when I say they respond, as in they differentiate between happiness, sadness, anger. That is very clear. But do they really understand? I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And every dog owner I know asks me this question. But I cannot answer it. I do not know. Because we cannot ask them, do you understand me? We can only tell is how do they respond to us, right? So the behavioral response, that will be the clear evidence. Of course, physiological evidence. As in one of my studies, we measured the cortisol in their saliva. So that will be the other thing. So that, I mean, as long as, in that case, I found, you know, it matches. So the salivary cortisol actually increases together with the behavioral responses. So that gives us clear indication that the dogs were indeed showing some form of responses towards crying. So crying, I think I'll just, you know, go ahead with the crying. The reason why I choose crying, because crying is a distress signal. I mean, when we hear a baby cry, what do we do? As any human, whatever age, whether it's man, woman, young and old, we will respond. And how do we respond? We look at the child. We will look for the source of the child if we can't see it. We stand and pay even attentive. Other babies who cannot even talk sometimes cry when they hear a baby cry. So there is something very meaningful in this crying. But what is it that is meaningful in this crying, right? And why are we so responsive? One reason is possibly because we are wired for it. It is in because our young cry. And it's a sign that the young needs nourishment or care or whatsoever. And so we respond. Now, puppies don't cry. Puppies make puppy sounds. But the fact is, they do the same for the young. The young comes out the same kind of distress signal. Same here as in the same quality, not the same sound. Of course, the sound itself is in pitch, you know, amplitude. Everything changes. But the quality is the same or the reason behind is the same. And in this case, the dogs were alert. They were, to a certain extent, stressed because I can see the cortisol went up through the roof. And they were very stressed with this sound. There is no baby in my lap, just very loud crying. And the poor dog is stressed out just listening to it. Right. Adults show the same response with the same crying that I play back to them. But they don't do this to the babbling sound. So if one would like to argue that, oh, you know, because baby is just unique. I mean, how many of us have babies at any given time? So therefore, the baby control would then be a babbling sound, something which we don't hear every day as well. Mm-hmm. But dogs don't do it. they go to sleep instead because they're just as loud because I have to control for loudness, you know, and other things. But yet they go to sleep. Now, so clearly baby itself is not the issue here, but rather the signal coming through this crying.
What about adult crying or children?
Yeah. So crying? Some people ask, why don't we use... So we had tested with adult crying, but the problem with adult crying, the crying is not genuine. Okay. With adults, when we cry, I mean, you can have true wailing and howling, you know, a real distress sound. But it's very hard to get a good quality one, as in for our recording purposes. You know, if you, let's say you videotape someone in a funeral, there's too many background noise. So you cannot really discern that crying per se, right? Whereas a baby that cries, they don't care. I'm just upset. I'm just hungry. And they cry. They cry even when I test with my young adults who are not parents. They themselves consider it very annoying. They consider it very aversive. And they find, if you ask, are you in need? Do you think this baby is in need? And all of them will say, yes, they do. So you don't need training for this. You will respond to it. Mm. So, and that's the beauty about why we use crying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said earlier that this is not unique to the human baby. Mm. Dogs cry too. And how do they cry?
Oh, how do they cry?
They
sound different, yeah. Right. So after my PhD, I worked with another person in the University of Winnipeg, and she works on animals in what we call animal distress vocalizations. She works on deer. And with a fawn, so this is wild range, you know, free-range wild deer. And with a fawn, and you have macaw, you have all these other variety. They have seals, they have puppies, kittens, and everything. What she found was that as long as you play the sound of a young cry, no matter the species, adult female deer will turn back to that sound. They come running across the prairie for this sound, which is very unique. Now, one reason, why would you respond? You might say, okay, I respond because it's my child, my species. So if a baby cries, so I'm a human being, so of course we respond. But if it's a dog, maybe, maybe not. And if it's a deer, I don't even know how a deer, you know. So then you become, you know, because you're far more distant, right? But when we tested this, so with the adult female, in a wild range, I mean, where are the chances they will hear a puppy cry or a kitten cry? Why would they respond? But they do. When we test with young adults, again, humans, when we play back these sounds and you ask these questions, are they in need? What do you think is happening? They respond the same. Mm. Now, this is a very interesting response because you do not know these animals. Half of them, when I ask my students, do you know what's a macaw? Don't even know what is a macaw, but yet you respond to it. So it's a very unique response that we have. So this is an evolutionary trait, right? Mm. So
the next question would be, why did they evolve that way?
One is just like, you know, for evolution, you need to respond to the young for survival purposes. Simple as that. So following Darwin's principle, you want the young to survive. And if the young, this is almost the realm of, you know, altruism, because I want my young to survive, but may not need your young, because then it's a, you know, a fight over resources. But the fact that we still do it, for humans, we can ask, okay? Then they can respond yes and no. But with the animals, with the non-human samples, we see them responding like this. One reason we suspect is just that because they are young, they are not a threat. Mm. Okay, they may be food, but they are not a threat. Now, if I am in a secure environment, I'm fine, you know, and why not? Yeah, because they are not a threat to me, so leave it. I mean, somehow we will always care for our young. We will just do it. It's just like your parents. Who teach them to be a parent? They know how to parent. Is an instinct, and it's an instinct found across many mammals, and I would say almost throughout the entire animal kingdom. So that's the interesting bit.
Interspecies. So altruism across species only happen if they are seen as not a threat.
Possibly. This is always an argument because we don't really know how it works. You see, well, we know about kin selection, right? We, like I said, you know, because we are humans, we, you know, we will care the humans first and everything. But yet we see many evidence in the non-human sample to do this. And it can be in any forms, whether it is a crying sound, whether they are being threatened by a predator, whether they are just going for resources. I mean, somebody has to starve a little bit in order for another one to eat. But is an interesting. So we get more reports every day, both in the wild and in the lab, that says that this is a possible trait found in the animal kingdom. Having said that, it sounds that, wow, everybody's so empathic. But it's not always the case, because this is based on what we observe. We do not know cognitively whether they have that understanding. We do not know if they are responding simply because it is, so I wouldn't say it is a, you know, for us, morally right, it's the right thing to do. But do they have the same understanding? That's a different matter. And that's something is very hard for us to identify.
Yeah. This goes to the core of the philosophical conundrum, is it? Do we really mean what we say? And for dogs, it's apparent because they can't articulate their feelings. Mm. But so isn't measuring their stress levels that is as accurate as you can get, even within humans? You know?
As accurate as you can get, okay. With the bodily response, every animal, man or non-human, we do have our own variation. So our own responses will vary from one to another when exposed to the same stimuli. So yes, the cortisol, so that's why you test in large groups in order to get a more robust answer rather than, you know, just test two dogs, for example. However, you can always complement that with other forms of measurement. So one of the suggestions I made in my research was actually to do what we call lateral hemispheric. So basically, you measure the tympanic membrane temperature in the ear because it does respond to the brain hemispheres. It does respond. So if you are looking at a positive, you know, happy occasion or versus a negative or a negative, you know, a sad occasion, for example, the brain will respond differently because the blood will rush differently because you're processing it. So that's one way of looking at it. Of course, conventional research would also suggest doing anal temperature, because the body temperature goes up as well. You know, it's like when your fight or flight response, you know, certain things. So you can do various bodily measurements. In humans, we have, of course, brain imaging. That would be the best. You can see in fMRIs, you can see in EEG, you can see many things. And they can tell you what they mean. So even back to your question, do we mean what we say? They can tell you one thing. So like, you know, you fill up a survey, you may not want to do it, so you just say, yeah, yes, yes, yes. You know, those kind. I mean, that's right. Normal, yeah. But you cannot lie in fMRI. Right. You cannot control the blood traveling in your brain and say, okay, stop right there. You can't do that. So that's why a lot of people like to go into both aspects, because then you are seeing whether they are, you know, they complement each other, whether it makes sense and these kind of things.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Yong Min Hui about the psychology of dogs. We are ushering in today the year of the dog, and we're using this excuse to talk about the psychology of canines. After the break, I'll ask her more about the morality of dogs, whether they feel a sense of justice, and whether dogs dream at night or in the day. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Troy Antic. My guest today is experimental psychologist Dr. Yong Min Hui. And we're talking about the psychology of dogs. This is because in response to the fact that this year we are ushering in the year of the dog. So we can reasonably conclude that dogs do feel a sense of empathy. Do they have also a sense of morals or justice or fair play?
Okay, so I want to just elaborate a little bit about empathy. When we talk about empathy in very academic sense, and also I think you can see it in real life, there are actually two aspects to it. There is the affective empathy and there is the cognitive empathy. Affective will be like emotional contagion. An example, you go to a concert, you know, and then everybody do the Mexican wave. Now, you do it too. Now, you think, okay, this is very stupid, but I'm still doing it. And you're thinking, why am I doing it? But that's because, it's, you know, the emotions are traveling and they are contagious. That's why we call them emotional contagions. The same thing when I said earlier, if a baby cries, you put in a room with other babies start crying. And I mean, they are not wet, they are not hungry, but they cry because they hear another baby cry. Why? So this is what we call, you know, affective empathy. So you need not understand what's going on, but you feel it and so you respond. Right? The other bit I say is cognitive. Cognitive empathy is like your perspective taking. So I understand, I see you cry, I ask you why you cry, or because I see that you lost your shoe, for example, so you're crying. So I understand. So it's like, you know, I'm taking the perspective of another person, right? So these are different. Now, having that, that's what we call second order. Now, that's like higher thinking. So in dogs, or rather in my particular study, I could only look at the first bit. That's why the crying bit, yeah? And now coming to the second one, you're asking me, do dogs have a sense of fair play or justice and morality? I did not look into this personally, but I am aware of some people, some researchers outside, they are based in Austria, and they looked at about how dogs respond to inequality. Now, it's a very interesting and very smart study. You try it with your dogs next time. I highly recommend it. You give your dog a treat, and you have, of course, you need two dogs. Yeah, you give one dog a treat, and you treat the dog with one treat and by shaking its paw, right? You give, you keep on doing one treat to each dog. Keep on doing. Now, suddenly, you favor the dog on your left and give two treats. But the right dog continue to get one. And then the left dog gets three treats now, and the fellow get one. What they found was that the dog that keep getting one stopped giving his paw. Like, why am I cooperating when I'm still getting one? This person get three. So, and why would you do it? So it, there are a few things to it. Number one, dogs can count. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, my dog can count.
But now, how do they express that?
So they stop cooperating.
Oh, I see.
Because the dog, you train them to cooperate, right? They learn, because dogs are very good when it comes to treats. I mean, they're all food motivated, right? So the moment you start training them, they get used to it. And they are, even before you could offer the treat, they will offer their paw because I know I'm going to get a treat, right? So this is what we call operant conditioning. But over time, you keep doing, and the dog notices that one more dog is getting, not fair. And so when they did that, they found that the dogs all stopped cooperating. Now, they tested, I think, easily 30 over dogs. So it's not just that one dog is so brilliant, but across all dogs. And that suggests that dogs actually recognize some form of inequality here. Now, we also know this this particular trait found in chimpanzees. Yeah, so like one gets grape, another one gets cucumber. They all love grapes. They love raisins. They like this
sweet very stuff.
Yeah, they do, exactly like humans, right? So they like it. And one person keeps saying, "Why am I getting cucumber? This fellow's getting grape." And that really funny video, if anybody gets to see it, it's by Franz de Waal. The chimp start throwing the cucumber back at, like, how dare you? How dare you be? And you can tell the dogs when they are unhappy, they stop cooperating, they turn around. They're like, you know, I'm not talking to you until you are wanting to be fair. So do they have a sense of morality? That I cannot answer. Do they have a sense of fairness? Potentially, yes. But you see, we always use food. Food is something that they understand very clearly. It's a common ground between the man and the dog. If we were to try other forms, I do not know. Maybe let's say a play toy, a squeaky toy. I do not know whether it will work just as well. There is a certain value attached to food, and especially if they like it very much. So I wouldn't know. And I suspect they might still show it, but probably in a much smaller effect. Yeah. So, like, you know, okay, like, I'm fine without the, you know, without the toy. But you do not withhold my treat from me. Maybe, I don't know. Yeah.
Does that count as intelligence, or do we only ascribe intelligence to higher order thinking?
Depends on how you wish to define intelligence. So we have many evidence of intelligence, like in various forms. One school of thought is about how well they solve problems. So we have the most classic example from Kola was the Sultan. I mean, the name of the chimpanzee was Sultan. And they had a banana hang up in the ceiling, and they are able to stack up all the boxes and to reach it. Now, nobody taught them to do it. The fact that you could solve it on your own suggests a high level of intelligence. And then we have people in New Zealand right now who show that the crows can, you know, make tools out of sticks and branches to reach to a certain food. So that's, again, another form of intelligence.
Problem-solving, right?
Yeah. So there was this one dog by the name of Rico, and then there's another dog by the name of Chaser. They're both border collies. They have been, you know, they appear in our academic world because they learn over 1,000 words, human words, and they could form sentences. So now it's a form of language. It's impressive. And I'm impressed with the researchers because they've really gone all out to prove that this is not a fluke. That this one dog, I mean, they had two separate groups of researchers, this particular dog could really learn, and they could do what we call fast mapping, which means a language mapping process. It's something that we children do, but the dogs can do. We even have a lot of dog researchers who say that dogs, an adult dog, the smart ones especially, have about the intelligence of a two-year-old child. It's a very broad claim. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And without language itself, we do not know for sure, but there's been many evidence to suggest that it is probably true. So they are intelligent. But again, the definition of intelligence, what are you looking at? Are you looking at language? Are you looking at problem solving? Are you looking at culture? But how they want to form? Because dogs also live in packs. So how do they want to survive? You know, we see the dogs that I tested are all domestic dogs, meaning these are your pet dogs, right? So they live with you. You have many years of, you know, many hours with them. That same age dog in a shelter or your stray dogs, how do they then respond? Because they don't have that same amount of human contact. Would they be different? Possibly. Because if we believe that we are involved in the training and the evolve, you know, all the traits that we want to see, there is a possibility. But because I don't test the dogs in shelters, so I do not know. But I do know people who are there and they say that they don't see it. They don't see the same ability appearing what we see in our pet dogs. Right. So having that human contact, not only, it's a form of anthropomorphism, because we see them and therefore we think they understand us, but being close to us also helps them to really understand us to a certain extent. Yeah. So, yeah.
Do we need to account for things like trauma or depression in dogs who are strays?
Trauma and depression, I wouldn't know. But we do have for anxiety because it is a common problem in dogs for anxiety. Dogs do develop anxiety, especially if they have thunderstorms, lightning, fireworks. So really loud sounds, yeah. And there are, in the veterinary world, there are medication to treat this naturally. There's also behavioral therapy for the dog to overcome. It's just like us, you know, when you have a certain, you know, it can be debilitating. We do need to factor this in, especially those that are in shelters, because often it's not so much whether they had trauma or depression. We do not know their history. We do not know how they end up in the shelter. Normally, 9 out of 10 is because they were strays at first and someone brought them in. So we do not know the kind of upbringing. So the dog may be perfectly fine in its own world, may not have suffered anything physical, may not have had any particular altercation or whatever, but we do not know. And the problem is when you do not know, it's very hard to make any form of judgment out of it. Yeah.
So two things I want to pick up on on your previous answer about language and then about the fact that they live in packs. For language, the fact that the best one can learn up to over 1,000 language,
a thousand words.
How do we know that they understand the actual meaning of the word rather than just ascribing memory to that particular symbol?
That one dog, the one that was the very impressive, her name is Chaser. And so what they did was they form nonsensical sentences. And she could, like, okay, it's nonsense, I'm not doing anything. And so it's amazing, yeah? Because, I mean, she obviously she was taught in English. So it was vocabulary, so 1,000 words vocabulary. She didn't obviously learn syntax or semantics to a certain extent. But she was able to get the whole meaning across. So it was not a case of just memory. So, I mean, it's easy to, you know, because memory you can train. You can train and you can increase your memory capacity. But in her case, she was able to start stringing words together. And that's the impressive bit. So they were able to show evidence of that. But this is just one dog out of the millions of dogs around the world. I bet when owners say, oh, my dog knows when I'm sad, or my dog knows when I say wait. So we often use commands like wait, leave, stay, sit. Notice that we tend to use singular words. We don't say, sit down and wait for me, because it's, for one, you realize dogs don't have a very long attention span.
Right.
They'll be like, they stop after maybe the second word. And the second thing is because of how we deliver such commands. I mean, sit down and wait for me is not as impressive as just say, wait, right? So there's more meaning there. So,
is that specific to the English-speaking culture? Are there also one-word commands in other languages that's preferable?
Okay. There is. So, and the often it doesn't matter how you say it. It doesn't, I mean, as in what language you choose to say. Even if you say in Malay, duduk, right? Mm-hmm. Notice the how you emphasize and accentuate certain words, certain consonants and vowels, how we go up and down. So the how we deliver, so our, when our pitch goes up, goes down, and how it matters because they pick this up. So in behavioral schools, especially they have hunting dogs, when you train certain things, they use whistles. So they use short blasts, long blasts. So the dog pick up based on this also. Mm. So you can say, you can start talking in Swahili or whatever. The dog will still follow you, right? Yeah. Will still follow you. But they, what they're picking up, what we suspect is most of the time, is the picking up of the tone.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
The up and down. So
you could say something really affectionate, but in a stern tone, and they would think they did something wrong.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it's possible. Yeah, my study actually showed that they really don't care, but but there are studies to show that they do respond differently. So if you say in a very stern voice, then they stop. They're like, oh, okay. But if you turn around too bad, it's all mine. You know, those kind of, if you especially try to stop the dog from eating a treat, right? So they'll be like, oh. But the moment you turn around, or if you just make a slight difference, the treat is there. So, yeah.
So the second point was the fact that they are conditioned to live in packs. So when we domesticate them and isolate them in our house as pets, and they live all by themselves in terms of their species, is that harmful for their psychology?
Okay, so dogs evolve from wolves. So they're Canis lupus. And so wolves, as you know, live in packs also. So dogs live in packs. And we, as today with the modern world, often we leave the dog at home at least 8 hours a day. Is it harmful for them? The answer, I mean, there are two schools of thoughts here. I'm not a professional dog trainer, but I met many and some said, yes, it is. Because they have no form of, you know, intellectual communication. Like, because with us around, but you see, if they are with you all around, all they do is just lie at your feet and sleep as well. So, I mean, what intellectual communication are we talking about?
Nonverbal communication.
Yes, nonverbal. Mm. So it's just that it's like we are a secure base for the dog. So the dog just needs to look at you. It's like how a child looks at us. You know, from the corner, it's like, oh, mommy's still there. Fine. Mm. You know, everything's good. But mommy is disappearing. Okay, now the world's becoming to look very terrifying. So we suspect it's the same thing. Now, some dogs are able to be conditioned. I mean, they've been trained very well, so they are okay to be 8 hours by themselves. And some dogs are not. And that's why when you come back, you see your house is trashed because the dog has just gone crazy. But again, it depends on how much the owner wants to do, because you can. I mean, the question is it harmful for the dog, right? Mm-hmm. It is if you don't spend the time training your dog, you know. And I know many people who actually go home during lunchtime to take the dog out for a walk, feed the dog, talk to the dog. And studies have shown that it's good for the dog and it's very good for the owner. Actually, the benefit is not so much for the dog, it's actually us. And how do I know this? Because when you ask them, their stress levels go down, their cortisol goes down, blood pressure goes down. Some of them who are on medication is also unregulated. You know, I mean, of course, we can say there are many factors. But one of the factors is the fact that you take time off to spend time with your dog. And that alone, that effect alone, is more meaningful. So the benefits is actually for us, right? So, again, to the dog themselves, I'm sure they're happy to see you anyway, as long as you are there.
Right.
Yeah. But yes, I would.
People also complain about the upkeep of having to care for their dog, cleaning up after them.
Dogs, one of the many reasons, like, okay, across the world, the most popular animal is the cat. And the second is the dog. One reason is because the cat is easier to manage. Easier to manage because they can tolerate the 8 hours by themselves. Mm. And the other thing is, of course, many of us now live in high-rise buildings, and dogs do need space. They need space for exercise. They need the compound. They need the yard, and they need the park. So it's easier to keep a cat in that sense, and cats are cheaper in that sense. Mm-hmm. So dogs, on the other hand, you know, the upkeep, the veterinary costs, the jabs and everything, they're the same, whatever animal you want to have. But there is more time required. And that becomes a problem to many people. And that's why they opted for cats, because it's unfair to your dog. You know, your poor dog is just waiting for you to come home. And what if you are the person who works late? What if you are the person who put in 80 hours a week? Your poor dog is going to be very lonely.
Yeah. Get a companion for them? Is that a...
That is has been proposed as a solution. So the two dogs... the thing is, of course, this is the proviso that the dogs get along. Yes. You know, and then there's always a dog who likes to be a bit more dominant than the other. Right. Or you have a dog that's... because of the different ages. So the dog is a puppy up to the age of 2. So they are juveniles and then they become an adult. Then they become a senior when they turn 8. Mm. And senior dog, depending on size, I mean, a very large breed dogs, they don't live as long as the smaller breeds. And, you know, they get along, but sometimes they don't. It's just like humans, right? You get along and sometimes you don't. And if you don't get along, your place is going to be even more trash than ever. So, but yes, the suggestion sometimes is to have two dogs and at least they keep each other company.
At the risk of anthropomorphizing again, do they feel jealousy, like with the introduction of new dogs or new babies?
They do. But this is, again, like a lot of... again, these are all anecdotal, yeah? So no real evidence to show, but there's been cases where we have a new baby coming in, the dog is jealous because now the attention is no longer on the dog. One reason is because some dogs are treated as a substitute child. Mm. So there are many young couples today who have dogs who are... essentially their children. You know, they call themselves mommy. They call the dog my baby. So that says to what extent they've elevated that social status of the dog, right? So they see the dog beyond an animal. And if it makes you happy and it doesn't, you know, isolate you from other things, that's not a problem. The problem is when you start, you know, going a bit off around the bend. But the thing is, when you have another dog or you have another child or you have a child, something, the dog may not, because it's a sudden loss of attention. It's like sibling rivalry, right? When you have a younger brother or sister, it's like, who is this? You know, taking my mom's attention away. So it's the same concept. And we do see these cases, or I do hear them. But normally you socialize. So then it'll be fine.
Yeah. And this is, I guess, the question that I most want to ask. Mm. Do we know whether dogs dream?
I have no idea to that question. Possibly. Why not? I mean,
because we dream, humans at least, because we are visual creatures, right? We navigate the world through pictures and images. But for a dog, they go through the world through their nose and smell. So
dogs' vision is not the same as human. In fact, they have poorer vision than us. But of course, their olfactory is, their nose is far more powerful than us. Do they dream? There seems to be evidence that they do. Because if you see, sometimes you can tell if they're dreaming because they, in their doggy bed, they behave like they had a nightmare. but I don't know.
Yeah.
But the short answer is I have no clue.
What about what they're thinking when, you know, they're waiting outside for you to come home?
Again, this is how we perceive. Right. What are they really thinking? I do not know. Because, you see on YouTube sometimes, you see about how dogs just waiting at the door for you to, you know, come up from your car and then you walk up your driveway, for example, and you see the dog bounding at you. Mm. As an owner, what's going to happen is you're going to feel extremely happy because someone is welcoming you home and it's with such, like, you know, limitless love. And you feel, wow, my dog is such a loving creature. It's so great. And it makes you happy, right? One hand, we can say the dog, I mean, if we are going to be very rich explanation, we say the dog recognize you're coming home, I'm happy my owner is coming home, and so I'm displaying it. But when you come home, you also feed the dog, right?
Yeah.
Your coming home means I'm getting my dinner. Mm-hmm. Of course I'm going to be happy. I'm going to get dinner right now. So is the response because of, yes, my owner is coming home and, you know, I'm all good, or is it because I'm seeing you, therefore dinner is coming? We do not know, because there's a lot of operant conditioning that we are not aware of. We do this to our dogs all the time. And that's the thing. We do not know what are they really thinking. And we do not know if that response is really due to them understanding the context, or are they just responding because they link us to another stimulus. So,
So much to understand. Are there a lot of studies going on about,
in dogs?
Yeah,
yes.
To understand the psychology.
There are a couple of research labs. One of them is the Family Dog Project in Hungary. They are actually the world leaders. Then the other one, of course, in Austria. And then there are many others. So they're in Western Europe, in the States. You started off by asking me why dogs, right? Yeah. And I said because they're man's best friend. anything to do with social signals, they are the best model to look at. So simply because of this ability. Now, imagine a wolf. Would you take a wolf into your home? You would not, because you know that's a vicious animal. And you wouldn't put your wolf next to your baby either. But you might let your dog sleep next to your child. And we see that a lot on YouTube as well. The fact that we have managed to sort of take away the viciousness of the wolf, and now what we see, and you know, even-tempered, a mild dog, you know, and the dog allows your child to pull his ears, tail, everything to do with it, you know, without even snarling, says that how far the wolf dog now has, you know, come into today. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, because of these social things about how they have learned to develop and mimic us, to some extent, a lot of it is actually imitation. Because if, like I said, if I show you happiness when you come home, if I'm the dog, I show you happiness, I get a food reward, I will continue showing this because I'm going to get my treat. And that's either food or a walk or whatever it is. But if I'm gonna be snarl, you know, I'm just going to snarl at you, growl at you, and I don't get anything, there's no reward, right? So why should I do it? So these traits has been maintained, and basically, we suspect it's also genetically maintained, because dog breeders will always try to breed from those that, you know, show this nice temperament. Mm. You don't want to breed from a vicious one, because no one wants them, because it's too risky, right? And it's so it's just too risky. So you continuously, so we only take, you know, the good ones, what we think is good. And so for all the social stuff, whether it's communication, hand signals, face, voice, empathy, morality, and all of this. So they are actually a good model because they can respond this way. And we sort of, we can also look at our children and see how, because sometimes we want to know, is by studying them, we are learning about ourselves also. Where does this come? You know, how does it appear?
So where's the cutting edge now in terms of dog research?
A lot to do. There's this group in Emory. They actually gone into fMRI. So to your question, do they really dream? Do they think? Do they really know these things? So they are looking at brain activation. It's amazing how they manage to train the dog to sit quietly in an fMRI machine. It's so loud. And for them, I bet it's deafening. And
respond to command as well, right?
Yeah. So it's amazing. So this is the way forward. I mean, that's what they're doing. And also many people are looking about how they respond to, because everybody is so keen. And one reason why we always attract attention is because there are just so many dog owners. They just want to know. So like if I'm saying a command to my dog, does the dog understand me? It's a simple question, but we can look at it in various ways. And I know people who are doing this. So they look at how, when we utter a particular command, like, you know, whether it's a low tone, high tone, and if you manipulate them, if you change the expression, or you make it a male speaker, female speaker, you know, there are many things you can look into. And what are they responding? So you can just look. It's endless. It's endless. As long as there are dogs, there will be many researchers looking at it.
If you miss any part of this interview, you can download the podcast via the BFM app, available now on Google Play and the App Store. Our Facebook page is BFM The Bigger Picture. Dr. Yong, thank you very much for being here today.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
And happy Chinese New Year to all. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.